You're listening to Season 2, Episode 25 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey, what's up, storytellers? Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. Their MFA writing program has been around for 35 years. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low residency writing programs in the country. We have number one New York Times bestselling author Renee Audier of The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger duology on the show with us today. For writers who are struggling with creating fleshed out characters, Renee's episode is a lifesaver. She walks us through her character-driven writing process and breaks down how to build multi-dimensional characters. Renee takes it even further and generously gives us an example from her book and shares exactly how she sets up a scene to highlight the main character's attributes. We touch on a lot more awesome topics, and probably my favorite part of our discussion is when we deconstruct what it means to have anxiety and how to combat it with gratitude and empathy. Let's dive right in. Hey, Renee, thank you so much for being on the show today. How are you?
I am doing so well, Yin. Thank you so much for taking some time out to chat with me. I really appreciate it.
I am so excited to have you on the show, and I know a lot of listeners are going to go bonkers, so let's get started. How did you first fall in love with writing?
I moved to the U.S. when I was 9 from South Korea, and I didn't speak any English. So you can imagine when I came over here, I was this girl, I played the violin, I had glasses. My mother had my hair in unironic Princess Leia buns and these patent leather Mary Janes and lacy socks. When all these girls were wearing Keds with the big bobby socks and the leggings with the stirrups and giant t-shirts that went through that plastic sort of ring that you knotted at your like hip. I was not a winner. I was just So the kids are kind of rough because you're 9 and you're right around that age when people are trying to figure out the pecking order, I guess is the best way to describe it. So I was teased kind of mercilessly, especially for not speaking English well. So I kind of turned to books to help me learn English a little bit better. My grandmother gave me all of these Nancy Drew books and my aunt gave me all of these Sweet Valley High books and these kind of things. So I really fell in love with reading then. And then later on, I tried to write, I guess, would amount to being Nancy Drew fan fiction. Then I went to school and I studied poetry in college. I studied it alongside political science because I wanted to have a job that made money. And I was thinking about going into law.
What? Law? Wait, where did that come from?
My mother is South Korean and I was raised doctor, lawyer, engineer, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I could not be a doctor because I was god awful at math. Zero interest in biology. I was like, this is just so boring. It's ironic because my sister is getting her doctorate degree in biology. And then once I graduated from school, I just started posting short stories on Fiction Press. And people told me, you know, you should really consider getting something published. I was like, oh, okay. And I got a book on getting published. I made every mistake imaginable. So it was really one of these things where I sort of fell into it. And then once I started doing it, I knew this was something I needed to do with my life because the last thing I would think about before falling asleep was my writing. And I would often edit dream space that's sort of between being awake and asleep. So you kind of know what's going on around you, but you don't have total control over it. And I would be editing what I had been working on the day prior in that sort of dream space. And I knew that this was probably a thing if that's what I'm so naturally inclined to want to do, even in my dreams. I'm a big person with fashion too. I love fashion and makeup and design. And I liken it to finding that perfect pair of jeans. Like you're fine with the jeans you had before until you find the ones that really fit.
You mentioned that your mom is South Korean. And then how about your dad?
My father, he's American. His family is of Scottish descent, though. So I'm a half Scottish. And I'm sure it's like Scots-Irish. My mother's family is South Korean. They all live in Seoul.
Your last name is so interesting and it's beautiful. That's why I'm like, what? That's a Scottish last name?
No. It's actually my husband's last name.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. I was like, wait.
Yep. His last name is Ahdia. It's Persian.
How are your parents feeling right now? Trust, because from similar Asian background, they didn't exactly mention lawyer, but they did talk about pharmacist and doctor. Obviously, doctor is out the window. How did your mom and your dad feel about you gravitating towards writing?
Like at the beginning, I think that they just thought, as I did, honestly, that this was just like a hobby. It was something that I wanted to do as a creative outlet. Both of my parents are musicians, and they had always kind of dissuaded us from following along an artist's path. I think they understood that it's very difficult. Yeah. It's very difficult to get any success and any sort of recognition as an artist. Both of my parents have doctor degrees in music. It's such a struggle, any sort of art form, unless you're really in that very, very privileged and lucky, 1-2%. It's a constant struggle. And I think they obviously didn't want that struggle for their kids. So they always quietly dissuaded us from pursuing that at the same time that they gave us piano lessons and violin lessons and all this sort of stuff. And I loved having artistic outlet. I think they just thought the writing was another artistic outlet for me. Again, because I just sort of took on this mantle very slowly. It wasn't something that one day I was this and the next day I was a writer. I was very carefully putting on this mantle. I never stopped to ask them. I think my mom truly realized this was a thing whenever The Wrath and the Dawn sold, and sold well to Penguin and had so many different... The Wrath and the Dawn was the fifth book that I'd ever written. And I think for a long time, everyone was just like, this is just what Renee does in her spare time. And then when somebody was willing, again, it's sad but true. I hate even saying this because it's something we hate to tell other aspiring authors. The money sort of validates all of your efforts. And it's a terrible thing to say, but it's sort of true. And it's not even that it validates your efforts to you. I think it validates your efforts to everyone else, because everyone else just sees you as taking time away from what you should be doing, especially as a woman, which is doubly unfair. Like, they think that you should be being a better wife, a better daughter, a better mother, all these different things. And you're spending all this time with your made-up worlds and your made-up characters. The only reason that they see it as justifiable is when you start making money. Yeah. I would think the same thing with where you're coming from too. It began like as something that was more or less, people saw it as a hobby, and you're like, no, this is what I do.
Absolutely. Like when I was an actor, I remember loving theater, and then my mom, I came home, I'm like, I'm gonna be an actor. And then she's like, No, you're not. You're gonna be a business person, or you're gonna do pharmacy. I'm like, nope. Both my parents were like, how are you going to make money? How are you going to put a roof over your head? My dad's entire side, they were totally against it, saying, oh, you'll never get a role. You're Asian. Your eyes aren't big enough. Your boobs aren't big enough. So America isn't ready for Asians. And this is like years ago. And it's only when I started booking gigs on TV, they started seeing me on the screen and hearing how much actors are making and stuff like that. That's when they're like, I knew it. That's right. You represent the family. You go. I'm like, what? Go where? You weren't there for me when I, like, you know, but it's like, it's only validated when they have some sort of proof. And whether that means hearing how much the paycheck is, or actually seeing your book on the display selling in Barnes & Noble. Yeah, it's so true what you're saying. It's all artists. It's fucked up, to be honest.
It absolutely is, yeah.
Artists have to make sure to not question themselves and their happiness.
But it's fascinating, too, because if you think about it, we have to question ourselves. So it's almost this impossible dichotomy. So you have the side of, if we're not questioning ourselves, we're not pushing ourselves to do better, to try harder. And questioning whether or not this is the right course of action for us, whether this is the right venue for our artistic impulses to be like put out there. But at the same time, you have to find satisfaction with it. That's like, I think, the eternal struggle, the gratitude that you need to get from what it is that you do have. And that sort of need to have more that propels us to excel in a very non-traditional job. It's impossible, I think, to straddle these two. And I think the struggle is real, the struggle is great, but at the same time, it's that need to find gratitude in everything that you do. And I think this is a struggle I see, not just in myself, but in a lot of my really good friends who are writers, because we are eternally dissatisfied with our work. That's what propels us to be perfectionists. And then we're eternally dissatisfied with what's going on outside of us, so we can feel that drive that we need in order to succeed and propel ourselves further and higher. But we also have to seek those moments of gratitude. And I think it's really difficult.
Have you personally struggled with that a lot?
I wouldn't say a lot. I think that for me, the bigger struggle is probably anxiety. And I guess they're sort of linked if you think about it. The anxiety comes about usually that crushing self-doubt I think everybody experiences in life. And I think that writers are constantly forced to question. It's sort of what propels us to tell a story because we don't necessarily just leave it alone. We're not just driving by a field and being like, what if all that corn came to life and it was sentient corn and wanted to take over the world or something like that? It's not just this errant thought that passes through our mind as we're driving by the field in question. It's something we give the corn names. We give the corn specific agendas, personalities, and we take it through an entire story. And that's all about asking questions. And when you're apt to ask those questions, especially when you're a character, driven author, and I'm a very character-driven author, that questioning sense, it comes back to you. You're constantly questioning what it is you're doing, and those questions can spiral you quickly into what am I doing with my life? I think it's a good struggle because I think there are good aspects to anxiety. I think that it makes me an author that functions well with deadlines. Embrace it. And I have a book that I'm working on right now that I can't talk about much, but I'm so excited for it, where my main character is really one of these people really hampered by fear and then winds up, she just embraces her fear and she lets it feed her rather than consume her. And that was absolutely inspired by anxiety on my part.
I love that you mentioned that you embrace anxiety because I know a lot of people try to suppress it and try to not allow it to take over because a lot of times they believe that it does hold them back.
Thank you so much. I think it's less about embracing the negative aspects of it and more about accepting. It's a reality. Like when you suffer from anxiety, it's not something that if you ignore it, it just gets worse. You sort of have to sit with it for a second. You have to understand the root cause of your anxiety and combat it with gratitude and empathy. And I think that those two things have really helped me not just understand myself, but understand other people better. And that's a benefit to everyone.
How are you able to figure that out?
I don't know that I figured it out totally. I still think that it's something I'm working on. It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
I think for me, a turning point was really understanding. And I see a therapist for my anxiety. So I think a lot of it is that. Just a simple practice of having someone sort of talk things through and offer insight, completely absent any bias or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it was really the understanding that I do have control over my thoughts and emotions, which was sort of revelatory to me. So the way I understand it, and this is the work of people who are infinitely more better and smarter and more learned in the field of psychology than I am, but this idea of your thoughts influence your feelings. Your feelings influence your actions. So if you can catch your thoughts at their inception, so if you're looking at a situation, let's say somebody cuts you off in traffic and your first inclination is to be like, oh, you fucking asshole, you know, whatever. And you're shaking your fist and you're like, that guy is a jerk. All right, that's one thing this guy did. And so then you're thinking that your subsequent feeling is you're angry. And then your subsequent action is you flip them off. If you could catch it at the thought and be like, that person might be having a bad day. That person might have made a mistake. It could have been an accident. So instead of me getting angry over it and flipping them off and being angry and upset for whatever, a couple of minutes because somebody flipped me off, or then taking it way too far and chasing them down. Road rage is one of these things that's incredibly gladiatorial. It's our version of gladiator game.
Actually, yeah.
It's weird. Like you'll see the most mild-mannered person like flip out in traffic. And I don't know what it is about driving cars and being on the road that sort of sheds our inhibitions and whatever sort of fury or anger or rage that we feel within us, we let out when we're driving. And it's accepted. It's socially accepted. And it's just interesting to me.
I cannot speak more highly of having a therapist for everyone. I don't care who thinks their life is perfect.
Great.
No one's fucking perfect. You're awesome. Okay, backtracking when you mentioned that you are very character driven. What was it that drew you to write about characters who exist in these morally gray areas?
I love that you said that. That's exactly what I'm trying to do because I feel like it's true to life. I feel like how often are we truly presented with a purely good decision or choice or a purely bad decision or choice? There's always shades of good and bad to every single choice that we have to us. We have these like silly phrases like the grass is always greener. Like you don't know what the other side actually is until you're there. But I feel like most people are inherently good people. And I don't think we set out to be the Cersei Lannisters of the world. And I would even argue that Cersei, now that she, I mean, spoiler alert for anybody listening, now that she has no children left.
Because yes, and lost her mind.
And she's lost her mind. But again, I don't think any of these people, we see them as villains on the screen or on the page, and we think to ourselves, this person is just inherently evil. And I really believe that everyone is the hero of his or her own story. They don't necessarily see themselves as this terrible, like, of course you have psychopaths and sociopaths, but they're
the exception.
They're the exception. Again, I feel like since we all are inherently good, what propels inherently good people to make really bad decisions? And I think it's because they can't tell the difference. And it's within that space, that morally gray space, when they're faced with impossible odds. And when I was writing the story for The Wrath and the Dawn, I knew I really wanted everybody to be plagued by these sort of like morally gray areas where they were trying to do the best given a shitty circumstance.
For the listeners who may not be familiar with your books, could you give us a snapshot of the world you created?
Absolutely. I could talk about this forever.
Amazing. I love it.
The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger are part of a completed duology that was finished as of April 26th of this year that's surrounding the story of Scheherazade, which is the frame narrative of the Arabian Nights or 1001 Nights. So she is the storyteller of, you know, some of these stories that are very beloved even in our canon, stories like Aladdin, Sinbad, Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. And the story of Scheherazade, I'm going to be bad Dr. Seuss for a second, is the Persian version of Beauty and the Beast. So you have this woman who comes in and she volunteers to sort of save a country and save a man from this terrible situation. So the backstory of this is this boy king in The Wrath and the Dawn, his name is Khalid, has been inexplicably taking a new bride every night and then subsequently murdering her at dawn. And this pattern has been going on for months now, and no one knows what the reason is. No one's offered any sort of reason. He's just become a monster in the eyes of his people. And Scheherazade's best friend succumbs to this. So she winds up having to marry this king and be murdered at dawn. And so Scheherazade comes to the palace and volunteers to be his next wife with this sort of hidden agenda to murder him, to get revenge. When she arrives there, she's very black and white. You know, you're evil. Everything you've done is evil. There's no excuse for what it is that you've done. And you are going to die by my hand. And then as she enters this world of this palace, and again, it's based on ancient Persia, it's fantasy. So there's magic interwoven throughout it. And if you're one of these people who's like a really hard history buff, you're going to be like, I don't know what's going on here. Just go with it. Like, it's a completely different world. It isn't even necessarily based on the Middle Eastern culture. It's much more about ancient Persia, which is the world is inspired by that space between the Abbasid Caliphate and the Sassanid Empire. So there are aspects of it that will be familiar to people who have any sort of understanding of Middle Eastern history, but also different, because I do think that there is a clear difference between what happened in Iraq, Iran, present-day Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria. Every respective culture has its own unique history. And I really wanted to shine a light celebrating what was beautiful about ancient Persia in the book. So you have a lot of food. I'm a huge foodie. And I learned to make a bunch of Persian food for the purposes of writing this book.
What?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Best kind of research excuse ever.
Oh, it wasn't even research. I just saw it as I'm so lucky that I got to do this because now I can make these beautiful, amazing dishes. It's so fun. And I love to cook. Yeah. So that's basically the research that went into this world. And I traveled in Egypt a couple of years ago and I took a lot of inspiration from Egypt. And again, even though the cultures are different, there's a vein of similarity there as well. One of my favorite scenes that I wrote in The Wrath and the Dawn was the scene in the souk. And that was directly inspired by the Khan el Halili, which is this very famous souk in present-day Cairo.
And a souk is a open-air market.
Yes. I don't even know how to describe it. It's almost like this tumor, I guess, is the best, because it has no rhyme or reason to it, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger as years progress. And you can get lost. It's this really fascinating mix of old world and new world, because you literally have people on corners selling lamps and carpets. And then another corner, you have people who are selling phone cards and stuff like that.
I would love to see that one day. That sounds beautiful. Okay, I'm going to ask a somewhat personal question. I'm super curious about this. You're talking about ancient Persia. You wanted to highlight that. Is this at all correlated to how you met your husband?
I would absolutely have to say this book would not not have come into existence without my husband and my husband's family.
Oh, wow.
Firstly, I would never have been able to do this culture, this sort of justice. And I do think whenever a writer, irrespective of your background, if you enter into telling a story or showing a narrative that comes from a place that is not your own personal experience, you have this, I would say, this pressing responsibility to not just get it right, but do it justice. I've been with my husband now for 15 years. We met when I was 18.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We got married after we'd been dating for 6.5 years. Family was my family, as you know, my family was his family. Every culture has its own way of dealing with its family, with its friends, its own sort of distinct aura. And having an understanding of the aura of Persian culture, the history, the poetry, the food, even the phrases. I would turn to my father-in-law often for a lot of the phrases that I worked throughout the narrative of both The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger, because I wanted to incorporate very Persian things into it. And then this isn't something that your average reader would necessarily pick up on, but I've had so many girls who are huge YA readers write me saying, this is so Persian, the way you've depicted the scene. My father said that same stuff. My grandfather used to say that to me. And that to me is, as a word nerd, is so gratifying, because it means that even though I'm not Persian, I did their culture justice. And that is, it's incredibly gratifying for me.
I'm from Long Island in New York, where there are a lot of Persian neighbors. And from growing up, I noticed, I don't want to overstep any boundaries, but sure. Is it culturally the boys? It's all about them. The boys are usually priority and girls are not really priority. Because I know in Asian culture, it was like that thousands of years ago. And even until this day, it's getting much better now.
We live in a patriarchal world. And I think certain cultures are still a few steps forward they need to make to sort of match what's going on in more progressive countries. And if you were to talk to me about Iran, I have a lot to say about the current state of Iran. But when you are deeply ingrained into a Persian family, or you sort of observe the way that the dynamic of a Persian family works, I still think it's very much ingrained in this idea that the man is the provider. But at the same time, I see women as having so much strength too in Persian households. Because Persian women, if you talk to anyone in the Middle East, they're notoriously outspoken women. They have a lot to say. And they're very sort of in your face about it. It's getting better and better. And I would say before the fall of the Shah and the rise of the Ayatollah and the rise of the Islamic nation of Iran, I would say that women, I mean, if you look at pictures of my mother-in-law before they had to leave Iran, she was wearing mini skirts and knee-high boots, and she had this crazy eye makeup that looked like tarantula legs off of her. It was just like, bam, it was really pretty. And you look at her, and this is in Iran. She's like hanging out in Iran with her girlfriends, and then within the course of like 2 years, they're all wearing the chador. They have to wear the headscarf because that's the law now in Iran, and since it's become an Islamic nationality, and they're covered from like neck to their heels. It's just very interesting to watch. But then I talked to some of my Iranian friends who were born and raised in Iran, and that's very much what it is out on the street. You're covered, but then you go inside somebody's house for a party, and you look just like we look when we go into a party, which is just interesting to me because they remove their headscarves and they have these beautiful hair and amazing makeup. It's interesting to me. I've never been to Iran, and I don't know that I can go because my husband's family, I don't think we would be allowed back into the country. Because of my husband's family, his uncle was affiliated with the Shah of Iran, and my husband's family is not Muslim. It's interesting. We would definitely, I'm pretty sure, and I know this because I've had other friends who are of the same faith who have been detained whenever they tried to leave Iran.
So Persian women are still known to be more outspoken, right? But is it accepted from majority of their society? Are the men okay with letting the women make decisions in the household and in the outside world?
It's difficult for me to speak to something that could be perceived as a generality. In my experience, I see Persian women, and again, I'm seeing Persian women within the United States. So I do think it takes a unique family to leave Iran, or a unique circumstance to uproot you and bring you here. And I do think that has a sort of, there's a rebellious aspect of that. I even think that when I think of my mom leaving Korea, it's an act of rebellion to like sort of leave where it is that you were born and raised. So that I think is a different sort of person in general. But in my experience and observing many Persian households, the women are very, very, very outspoken, and they're really, they can be domineering and very in your face and very challenging. My mother-in-law is a case in point. My mother-in-law is not afraid to challenge anyone. And it's sort of amazing because that image of this meek mannered Middle Eastern wife, it's never actually rooted in my mind, because I even see it. I have some really good friends who are Pakistani and really good friends who are Indian, and they are very tough, very in your face, and not afraid to get in the face of a man and tell that man how it is. So,
and the reason why I bring all this up is because your character, Shahrzad, is a very strong female character. That's why, actually, I'm super curious, is that common where the world is set?
It is a fantasy world, and there is sort of a modern sensibility to Shahrzad. There's a feminist undercurrent to everything that I write, and I really wanted that to come across. Because it's not even to combat, but if you look at it, I do think that there is this sort of Western perception of brown girls and brown families as being very subservient and sort of meek-mannered and, you know, under someone's thumb, usually a man's thumb. I have no doubt that that exists and that's a reality. That is not how I wanted to portray it, because I think that, again, across the board, you can have a white girl who's under the thumb of her father, a white woman who's under the thumb of her husband. I think that these things exist all across culture. But what I really wanted to showcase is a brown girl in a traditionally brown world who is embracing sort of modern sensibilities. And I think that that's what's wonderful about literature, and that's what's wonderful about writing fantasy. You can do that. You can take something that maybe wouldn't, I mean, I have no doubt that she could have been killed for much less than some of the things that she said to Khalid, Shahrzad I'm talking about, that Shahrzad could have died from many of the things if we were talking about, you know, a world that was strictly based on the truth, the reality of the past. But I do think that the inspiration, the character of Shahrzad, is somebody who did buck stereotypes and did take on this incredibly big challenge of getting in the face of a man who had committed atrocities and forcing him to question who he was and why it is he was doing these things. She is a hero, and she did it through, for me, which is such a powerful thing because I'm a storyteller, she did it using the power of story. That was just revelatory for me, and it was such a great inspiration. And any woman, regardless of what area or what part of the world they might have lived in, any woman who is willing to take on something like that, the task of like fixing a very broken man and sort of putting a mirror in his face and being like, what are you doing? That sort of personality, that sort of character, it transcends norms.
Do you have hope to work on a story tying in South Korean cultural influence in any way, or even Scottish? Is there any of that to your own roots that you're interested, that you want to touch on?
Absolutely. I think that all of my books, and it isn't something that I necessarily set out to do. It's not like some contrived decision but it's just what I love to write. Because I think first and foremost, writers are readers.
Yes.
And I want to write a book that I would like to read. And invariably, that is a book that brings to life a different world. And the next thing that I'm working on, the one that I mentioned earlier that I'm super excited about, is based in a fantasy East Asia. I am so excited about it. It was such a joy to work on. And I hope everyone embraces it as they've embraced The Wrath and the Dawn. And I just think it's something that I will always be doing. I will always be trying to bring a different world to life.
I know you're familiar with the awesome quote from George R.R. Martin about writers being architects or gardeners. Could you please explain to the listeners what that quote is and how it resonates with you?
So a lot of people who are within the writing community, we like to ask one another, are you a plotter or a pantser? Mm-hmm. And I hate these two phrases. So plotter, obviously being somebody who approaches the writing process having plotted everything out very heavily. And a pantser, air quotes, flies by the seat of his or her pants. I hate both of these. I think it's ridiculous. And George R.R. Martin, he has this wonderful analogy that I much prefer, saying that you're either an architect or a gardener. So an architect approaches a story and they have a scaffolding and blueprint. They know what it is they want to build, what style they want to build, an English Tudor, Cape Cod, whatever it might be. So that's how an architect approaches the story, whereas a gardener plants seeds and lets them grow. I love this analogy much more. I'm very much an architect, and I think it's always a struggle for people who identify very clearly along either line, whether they're an architect or a gardener, to sort of incorporate gardening aspects into my work, because I do think that being really rigid as an architect doesn't give you as much room to allow the creative process to take over. You just become very married to the story that you wanted to tell, the way you wanted to tell it. And often you have these moments of insight. And when I watch my friends who are gardeners, they will have these moments of beautiful insight. And because they've allowed themselves that latitude, they can really take the story to a different place, elevate the narrative, and they're open to these sort of things. Whereas someone like me, I will be a lot more rigid about entering like a new character or letting the story take on a different life or go down a different path. I think it would be better for me to incorporate more aspects of that gardener into my work because I am such an architect. So I see the value of both. But I think the best analogy I had, and I have a really good friend who made this analogy, she's a headlight writer. So she always knows what's directly in front of her, but she doesn't know necessarily what's around the next curve. And I think that's a really good way to be. And so it's something that I'm trying to aspire to incorporate into my own writing, being somebody who knows what it is they want to write immediately in front of them and has made a very clear sort of plot for what they're getting ready to write, but they don't know what's happening around the next corner. And that, I think, would be very liberating. It would be incredibly anxiety-inducing for me, but liberating to make that work.
You are more on the architect side right now. How does that process work for you?
I write these massive outlines on my computer. The genesis of any story I want to write begins with characters. So what I'll do is I will take a white sheet of paper and I will write, for example, Shahrzad's name in the center of this paper. And I'll put a circle around it and I'll start drawing branches off of it. Ooh. And on these branches, I will write character traits that I would like Shahrzad to embody. So let's say I want Shahrzad to be brave. I want Shahrzad to be loyal. And then once I have this sort of cloud of character attributes that I want Shahrzad to embody, I'll do the same exercise with all of my main characters. And then what I will do is I will look at that board and I'll have that in front of me and I will say to myself, okay, I need to craft a scene where I am showing that Shahrzad is brave as opposed to like telling, because you know that's always the internal struggle with an author is show, don't tell. And so for instance, just going back to the story of The Wrath and the Dawn, when I wanted immediately for Shahrzad to come across as brave, I crafted that opening scene of her walking down to marry this man who was going to kill her. Her attitude, the way in which she approached the situation, the interaction she had with people, even the way she held her head, the way she walked, the way she carried herself. I wanted to show that she was brave. And then what I do after that is once I have all of these different scenes that I've crafted in my head that embody these certain character traits, I start stringing them into a chronological narrative. And often what will happen is I'll see overlap. I'll see two scenes that convey the same character trait or the same interaction or get across the same sort of point. And I can throw out one of them. And then once I sort of string them together in chronological order, I have a story. And I always, at the top of every single page, I keep in mind, what is this character's motivation? So Shahrzad's motivation is revenge. I like those motivations to sort of be turned on their head about two-thirds of the way through their book. A new motivation sort of enter into the picture because I like that it's dynamic. And you don't want to have a character that's one-track-minded. You want to have a character that's multidimensional. And just as we as human beings at any given time may have three or four different agendas, I think it's important for characters to have that same sort of thought process, that they don't just want one thing in life. How do you define success? Success can be a moment. Fulfillment is a lifetime. So the difference between those two.
Thank you for breaking that down. You mentioned you wrote 5 books before The Wrath and the Dawn. Total of 7 now? How do you think you've evolved creatively?
I mean, I think I'm constantly evolving and constantly changing. Kind of circling back to one of the first points that we made, that idea of not being satisfied with what you have. And the problem with being a character-driven author, at the very beginning, I would have these stories that had these, what I thought were great interactions and these really amazing characters and virtually no plot. So you're just having these exchanges that are thought-provoking and fascinating, but they're not strung together in a cohesive narrative. So I think the problem I had in the beginning when I started writing is I didn't have much of a story. So what has happened over the course of writing all of these books is I've really started to recognize that plot is something I have to work on heavily from the beginning. I have to have a very clear purpose behind every single scene that I write, or else I'll sort of drift. I'll drift and meander, and I'll be like, oh, this is fun. Let's do this. Let's do this. And it's all great, and it's fun to write, but you still need to have a very clear arc for every single one of your characters. And so I've noticed with each book that I write, I think the plot gets a little bit tighter, and that's gratifying for me. Since I am somebody who plots everything out, who is an architect, it always strikes me as interesting that I lose focus because I'm so deeply invested in my characters. And I think that deep investment in character is absolutely necessary. If you don't care about your characters, why would a reader care about your characters? At the same time, those characters need to be a part of a very tightly woven narrative. I'm constantly challenging myself to say, you know, is this necessary? Does this further the plot? Does this further the plot? What am I trying to achieve in terms of plot in this particular scene? Yes, I'm getting across this character trait. How does it fit into the overall narrative? And I think that that is probably something that I've been very happy to see become easier for me with every book that I write.
It's admirable that you see where there is room for improvement and challenging yourself. I tip my hat to you.
Oh, man. Thank you so much.
That wraps up our conversation with Renee Audier. Renee, thank you so much for unpacking and analyzing your writing process and sharing your stories. I had the best time chatting with you. Listeners, was that inspiring or what? I'm so excited to hear your thoughts about Renee's episode. So head over to Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram and let me know at 88 Cups of Tea. Don't forget to head over to Renee's show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/RENEEAHDIEH. And don't forget to say hi to Renee on Twitter at RAHDIEH. And one more thing before we wrap up Renee's episode. If you're a writer or a poet looking to publish your work, I encourage you to learn more about today's sponsor. Vermont College of Fine Arts has two writing programs I'm excited to tell you about. Their MFA in Writing is one of the original low residency programs and frankly, one of the best in the country. Writers gather at VCFA's beautiful campus for two separate 10-day residencies each year. Imagine yourself immersed in a setting much like an intense writer's retreat where you're fully committed to workshops, lectures, and readings. After the residencies, you return home and work with a dedicated faculty advisor throughout the rest of the semester. The MFA in Writing and Publishing is VCFA's very first and brand new residential program that also focuses on improving your writing and giving you the tools to thrive in the arts. Every student learns directly from the agents, editors, and publishers. The cool thing is that it's a cross-genre program, which means if you're a poet, you're encouraged to learn from faculty in fiction or nonfiction. Imagine yourself learning and creating in this incredible writing community, all while living on their gorgeous campus in Montpelier, Vermont. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com. /VCFA to learn more about these programs and their MFA in Writing for children and young adults. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.